Other Early Stations and The Meter, Abridged from Edison, His Life and Inventions by Frank Lewis Dyer and Thomas Comerford Martin. The first Edison commercial station to be operated in this country was at Appleton, Wisconsin, but its only serious claim to notice is that it was the initial one of the system driven by water power. It went into service August 15, 1882, about 3 weeks before the Pearl Street station. It consisted of one small dynamo, of a capacity of 280 lights of 10-candle power each, and was housed in an unpretentious wooden shed. The dynamo electric machine, though small, was robust, for under all varying speeds of water power and the vicissitudes of the plant to which it belonged, it continued in active use until 1899, 17 years. Edison was from the first deeply impressed with the possibilities of water power, and, as this incident shows, was prompt to seize such a very early opportunity. But his attention was in reality concentrated closely on the supply of great centers of population, a task which he felt might well occupy his lifetime, and except in regard to furnishing isolated plants, he did not pursue further the development of hydroelectric stations. That was left to others and to the application of the alternating current, which has enabled engineers to harness remote powers and, within thoroughly economical limits, transmit thousands of horsepower as much as 200 miles at pressures of 80,000 and 100,000 volts. Owing to his insistence on low-pressure direct current for use in densely populated districts as the only safe and truly universal profitable way of delivering electrical energy to the consumers, Edison has been frequently spoken of as an opponent of the alternating current. This does him an injustice. At the time, a measure was before the Virginia legislature in 1890 to limit the permissible pressures of current so as to render it safe. He said, "You want to allow high pressure wherever the conditions are such that by no possible accident could that pressure get into the houses of the consumer. You want to give them all the latitude you can." In explaining this, he added, "Suppose you want to take the falls down at Richmond and want to put up water power. Why, if we erect a station at the falls, it is great economy to get it up to the city. By digging a cheap trench and putting in an insulated cable and connecting such station with the central part of Richmond, having the end of the cable come up into the station from the earth, and there connected with motors, the power of the falls would be transmitted to these motors. If, now, the motors were made to run dynamos, conveying low-pressure currents to the public, there is no possible way whereby the high-pressure current could get to the public." In other words, Edison made the sharp fundamental distinction between high-pressure alternating current for transmission and low-pressure direct current for distribution, and this is exactly the practice that has been adopted in all the great cities of the country today. Edison's lighting work furnished an excellent basis, in fact the only one, for the development of the alternating current now so generally employed in central station work in America, and in the McGraw Electrical Directory of April 1909, no fewer than 4,164 stations out of 5,780 reported its use. When the alternating current was introduced for practical purposes, it was not needed for arc lighting, the circuit for which from a single dynamo would often be 20 or 30 miles in length, its current having a pressure of not less than 5 or 6,000 volts. For some years, it was not found feasible to operate motors on alternating current circuits, and that reason was often urged against it seriously. It could not be used for electroplating or deposition, nor could it charge storage batteries, all of which are easily within the ability of the direct current. But when it came to be a question of lighting a scattered suburb, a group of dwellings on the outskirts, a remote country residence or a farmhouse, the alternating current in all elements save its danger was and is ideal. Its thin wires can be carried cheaply over vast areas, and at each local point of consumption, the transformer of size exactly proportioned to its local task takes the high-voltage transmission current and lowers its potential at a ratio of 20 or 40 to 1 for use in distribution and consumption circuits. Unless he could secure an engine of smoother running and more exactly governed and regulated than those available for his dynamo and lamp, Edison realized that he would find it almost impossible to give a steady light. He did not want his customers to count the heartbeats of the engine and the flicker of the lamp. Not a single engine was even within gunshot of the standard thus set up, but the emergency called forth its man in Gardner C. Sims. A talented draftsman and designer who had been engaged in locomotive construction and in the engineering department of the United States Navy. He may be quoted as to what happened. "The deep interest, financial and moral, and friendly backing I received from Mr. Edison, together with valuable suggestions, enabled me to bring out the engine, as I was quite alone in the world, poor. I had found a friend who knew what he wanted and explained it clearly. Mr. Edison was a leader far ahead of the time. He compelled the design of the successful engine. Our first engine compelled the inventing and making of a suitable indicator to indicate it, the Tabor. He obtained the desired speed and load with a friction brake, also regulator of speed, but waited for an indicator to verify it. Then, again, there was no known way to lubricate an engine for continuous running, and Mr. Edison informed me that as a marine engine started before the ship left New York and continued running until it reached its home port, so an engine for his purposes must produce light at all times. That was a poser to me, for a 5 hours run was about all that had been required up to that time. A day or two later, Mr. Edison inquired, "How far is it from here to Lawrence?" "It is a long walk, isn't it?" "Yes, rather," he said. "Of course you will understand I meant without oil." To say I was deeply perplexed does not express my feelings. We were at the machine works, Kirk Street. I started for the oil room when, about entering, I saw a small funnel lying on the floor. It had been stepped on and flattened. I took it up, and it had solved the engine oiling problem. And my walk to Lawrence, like a tramp actor's, was off. The eccentric strap had a round glass oil cup and a brass base that screwed into the strap. I took it off and, making a sketch, went to Dave Cunningham, having the funnel in my hand to illustrate what I wanted made. I requested him to make a sheet brass oil cup and solder it to the base I had. He did so. I then had a standard made to hold another oil cup so as to see and regulate the drop feed. On this combination, I obtained a patent which is now universally used. Edison had installed his historic first great central station system in New York on the multiple arc system, covered by his feeder and main invention, which resulted in a notable savings in the cost of conductors as against the straight two-wire system throughout of the tree kind. On November 20, 1882, only 2 months after current had been sent out from Pearl Street, he executed an application for a patent covering what is now known as the three-wire system. It has been universally recognized as one of the most valuable inventions in the history of the lighting art. Its use resulted in a saving of over 60% of copper in conductors, figured on the most favorable basis previously known, inclusive of those calculated under his own feeder and main system. The strong position held by the Edison system under the strenuous competition that was already springing up was enormously improved by the introduction of the three-wire system, and it gave an immediate impetus to incandescent lighting. Desiring to put the new system into practical use promptly, and receiving applications for licenses from all over the country, Edison selected Brockton, Massachusetts, and Sunbury, Pennsylvania, as the two towns for the trial. Of these two, Brockton required the larger plant, but with the conductors placed underground, it was first to complete its arrangements and close its contract. The Sunbury generating plant consisted of an Armington and Sims engine driving two small Edison dynamos having a capacity of about 400 lamps of 16 candle power. The indicating instruments were of the crudest construction, consisting of two voltmeters connected by pressure wires to the center of the electrical distribution. One ammeter for measuring the quantity of current output was interpolated in the neutral bus or third wire return circuit to indicate when the load on the two machines was out of balance. The circuits were opened and closed by means of about a half dozen roughly made plug switches. The bus bar to receive the current from the dynamos were made of number-aught-aught-aught copper line wire, straightened out and fastened to the wooden sheathing of the station by iron staples without any presence to insulation. Commenting upon this, Mr. W.S. Andrews, detailed from the central staff, says, "The interior winding of the Sudbury station, including the running of two three-wire feeders the entire length of the building from back to front, the wiring up of the dynamos and switchboard and all instruments together with bus bars, etc. In fact, all labor and material used in the electrical wiring installation amounted to the sum of $90. I received a rather sharp letter from the New York office expostulating for this extravagant expenditure and stating that great economy must be observed in future. The street conductors were of the overhead pole line construction and were installed by the construction company that had been organized by Edison to build and equip central stations. A special type of street pole had been devised by him for the three-wire system." Supplementing the story of Mr. Andrews is that of Lieutenant F.J. Sprague, who also gives a curious glimpse of the glorious uncertainties and vicissitudes of that formative period. Mr. Sprague served on the jury at the Crystal Palace exhibition with Darwin's son, the present Sir Horace, and after the tests were ended, left the Navy and entered Edison's service at the suggestion of Mr. E.H. Johnson, who was Edison's shrewd recruiting sergeant in those days. I reported to the office of Mr. Edison on Fifth Avenue and told him I had seen Johnson. He looked me over and said, "What did he promise you?" I replied, $2,500 a year. He did not say much, but looked it. About that time, Mr. Andrews and I came together on July 2nd of that year. We were ordered to Sudbury and to be ready to start the station on the 4th. The electrical work had to be done in 48 hours. Having traveled around the world, I had cultivated an indifference to any special difficulties of that kind. Mr. Andrews and I worked in collaboration until the night of the 3rd. I think he was perhaps more appreciative than I was of the discipline of the Edison Construction Department, and thought it would be well for us to wait until the next morning of the 4th before we started up. I said we were sent over to get going and insisted on starting up the night of the 3rd. We had an Armington and Sims engine with sight feed oiler. I had never seen one and did not know how it worked, with the result that we soon burned up the Babbitt metal in the bearings and spent a good part of the night getting them in order. The next day, Mr. Edison, Mr. Insull, and the chief engineer of the construction department appeared on the scene and wanted to know what had happened. They found an engine somewhat loose in the bearings, and there followed remarks which would not look well in print. On July 4th, the Sudbury plant was put into commercial operation by Edison, and he remained a week studying its conditions and watching for any unforeseen difficulty that might arise. Nothing happened, however, to interfere with the successful running of the station, and for 20 years thereafter, the same two dynamos continued to furnish light in Sudbury. They were later used as reserve machines and finally, with the engine, retired from service as part of the collection of Edisonia, but they remain in practically as good condition as when installed in 1883. Sudbury was also provided with the first electrochemical meters used in the United States outside New York City, so that it served also to accentuate electrical practice in a most vital respect, namely the measurement of the electrical energy supplied to customers. At this time and long after, all arc lighting was done on a flat rate basis. The arc lamps installed outside a customer's premises or in a circuit for public street lighting burned so many hours nightly, so many nights of the month, and was paid for at that rate, subject to rebate for hours when the lamp might be out through accident. The early arc lamps were rated to require 9 to 10 amperes of current at 45 volts pressure each, receiving which they were estimated to give 2,000 candle power, which was arrived at by adding together the light found at four different positions, so that in reality the actual light was about 500 candle power. Here again Edison laid the foundation of standard practice. It is true that even down to the present time the flat rate is applied to a great deal of incandescent lighting, each lamp being charged for individually according to its probable consumption during each month. Edison held that the electricity sold must be measured like gas or water, and he proceeded to develop a meter. Edison, however, had satisfied himself that there were various ways of accomplishing the task, and he determined that the current should be measured on the premises of every customer. His electrolytic meter was very successful and was of widespread use in America and in Europe until the perfection of the mechanical meters by Elihu Thomson and others brought that type into general acceptance. Hence, the Edison electrolytic meter is no longer used despite its excellent qualities. The principle employed in the Edison electrolytic meter is that which exemplifies the power of electricity to decompose a chemical substance. In other words, it is a deposition bath consisting of a glass cell in which two plates of chemically pure zinc are dipped in a solution of zinc sulfate. When the lights or motors in the circuit are turned on, and a certain definite small portion of the current is diverted to flow through the meter from the positive plate to the negative plate, the latter increases in weight by receiving a deposit of metallic zinc. The positive plate, meantime, loses in weight by the metal thus carried away from it. This difference in weight is a very exact measure of the quantity of electricity, or number of ampere hours, that have, so to speak, passed through the cell, and hence of the whole consumption in the circuit. The amount thus due from the customer is ascertained by removing the cell, washing and drying the plates, and weighing them in a chemical balance. Associated with this simple form of apparatus were various ingenious details and refinements to secure regularity of operation, freedom from inaccuracy, and immunity from such tampering as would permit theft of current or damage. As the freezing of the zinc sulfate solution in cold weather could check its operation, Edison introduced, for example, into the meter an incandescent lamp and a thermostat so arranged that when the temperature fell to a certain point or rose above another point, it was cut in or out, and in this manner the meter could be kept from freezing. The standard Edison meter practice was to remove the cells once a month to the meter room of the Central Station Company for examination, another set being substituted. The meter was cheap to manufacture and install, and not at all liable to get out of order. After the station had been running several months and was technically a success, we began to look after the financial part. We started to collect some bills, but we found that our books were kept badly and that the person in charge, who was no businessman, had neglected that part of it. In fact, he did not know anything about the station anyway. So I got the directors to permit me to hire a man to run the station. This was Mr. Chinook, who was then superintendent of the Metropolitan Telephone Company of New York. I knew Chinook to be square and of good business ability, and induced him to leave his job. I made him a personal guarantee that if he would take hold of the station and put it on a commercial basis and pay 5% or $600,000, I would give him $10,000 out of my own pocket. He took hold, performed the feat, and I paid him the $10,000. I might remark in this connection that years afterward I applied to the Edison Electric Light Company asking them if they would not like to pay me this money, as it was spent when I was very hard up and made the company a success and was the foundation of their present prosperity. They said they were sorry, that is, Wall Street sorry, and refused to pay it. This shows what a nice, genial, generous lot of people they have over in Wall Street. Chinook had a great deal of trouble getting the customers straightened out. I remember one man who had a saloon on Nassau Street. He had had his lights burning for 2 or 3 months. It was in June, and Chinook put in a bill for $20. July for $20, August about $28, September about $35. Of course, the nights were getting longer. October about $40, November about $45. Then the man called Chinook up. He said, I want to see you about my electric light bill. Chinook went up to see him. He said, are you the manager of this electric light plant? Chinook said, I have the honor. Well, he said, my bill has gone from $20 up to $28, $35, $45. I want you to understand, young fellow, that my limit is $60. After Chinook had had all this trouble due to the incompetency of the previous superintendent, a man came in and said to him, did Mr. Blank have charge of this station? Yes. Did he know anything about running a station like this? Chinook said, does he know anything about running a station like this? No, sir, he doesn't even suspect anything. One day Chinook came to me and said, I have a new customer. I said, what is it? He said, I have a fellow who's going to take 250 lights. I said, what for? He has a place down here in a top loft and has 250 barrels of rot-gut whiskey. He puts a light down in the barrel and lights it up, and it ages the whiskey. I met Chinook several weeks after and said, how is the whiskey man getting along? It's all right. He's paying his bill. It fixes the whiskey and takes the shudder right out of it. Somebody went and took out a patent on this idea later. In the second year, we put the stock exchange on the circuits of the station, but were very fearful there would be a combination of heavy demand and a dark day, and that there would be an overloaded station. We had an index like a steam gauge called an ampere meter to indicate the amount of current going out. I was up at 65th Avenue one afternoon. A sudden black cloud came up, and I telephoned to Chinook and asked him about the load. He said, we are up to the muzzle, and everything is running all right. By and by it became so thick we could not see across the street. I telephoned again and felt something would happen, but fortunately it did not. I said to Chinook, how is it now? He replied, everything is red hot, and the ampere meter has made about 17 revolutions. The station equipment at Brockton consisted at first of 3 dynamos, one of which was so arranged as to supply both sides of the system during light loads by a breakdown switch connection. This arrangement interfered with correct meter registration, as the meters on one side of the system registered backward during the hours in which the combination was employed. Hence, after supplying an all-night customer whose lamps were on one side of the circuits, the company might be found to owe him something substantial in the morning. Soon after the station went into operation, this ingenious plan was changed, and the third dynamo was replaced by 2 others. The Edison Construction Department took charge of the installation of the plant, and the formal opening was attended on October 1, 1883, by Mr. Edison, who then remained a week in ceaseless study and consultation over the conditions developed by this initial 3-wire underground plant. Some idea of the confidence inspired by the fame of Edison at this period is shown by the fact that the first theater ever lighted from a central station by incandescent lamps was designed this year and opened in 1884 at Brockton with an equipment of 300 lamps. The theater was never piped for gas. It was also from Brockton Central Station that current was first supplied to a fire engine house, another display of remarkably early belief in the trustworthiness of the service under conditions where continuity of lighting was vital. The building was equipped in such a manner that the striking of the fire alarm should light every lamp in the house automatically and liberate the horses. It was at this central station that Lieutenant Sprague began his historic work on the electric motor. And here that another distinguished engineer and inventor, Mr. H. Ward Leonard, installed the meters and became meter man in order that he might study in every intimate detail the improvements and refinements necessary in that branch of the industry. The difficulty of obtaining engineers in those days to run high-speed engines, 350 revolutions per minute, is well illustrated by an amusing incident in the very early history of the station. A locomotive engineer had been engaged, as it had been supposed, that he would not be afraid of anything. One evening there came a sudden flash of firing and a sputtering, sizzling noise. There had been a short circuit on the copper mains in the station. The fireman hid behind the boiler, and the engineer jumped out of the window. Mr. Sprague realized the trouble and quickly threw off the current and stopped the engine. Another important part of this period deserves special mention, as it was the pioneer in the lighting of large spaces by incandescent lamps. The installation of 5,000 lamps on the three-wire system was made to illuminate the buildings at the Louisville, Kentucky Exposition of 1883. And owing to the careful surveys, calculations, and preparations of H.M. Billingsley and the late Luther Sturinger, was completed and in operation within 6 weeks after the placing of the order. The jury of awards in presenting 4 medals to the Edison Company took occasion to pay a high compliment to the efficiency of the system. It has been thought by many that the magnificent success of this plant did more to stimulate the growth of the incandescent lighting business than any other event in the history of the Edison Company. It was literally the beginning of the electrical illumination of American expositions, carried later to such as splendid displays as those of Chicago's Wolf Fair in 1893, Buffalo in 1901, and St. Louis in 1904. Thus the art was set going in the United States under many difficulties, but with every sign of coming triumph. Reference has been made to the work abroad in Paris and London. The first permanent Edison station in Europe was that at Milan, Italy, for which the order was given as early as May 1882 by an enterprising syndicate. Less than a year later, March 3, 1883, the installation was ready and was put into operation, probably the first edifice constructed in Europe for the specific purpose of incandescent lighting. Here jumbos were installed from time to time until at last there were no fewer than 10 of them, and current was furnished to customers with a total of nearly 10,000 lamps connected to the mains. The Pioneer system was operated continuously until February 9, 1900, or for a period of about 17 years, when the sturdy old machines, still in excellent condition, were put out of service so that a larger plant could be installed to meet the demand. The new plant takes high-tension polyphase current from a water power 30 or 40 miles away at Paderno on the River Adda, flowing from the Apennines, but delivers low-tension direct current for distribution to the regular Edison three-wire system throughout Milan. About the same time that Southern Europe was thus opened up to the new system, South America came into line, and the first Edison Central Station there was installed at Santiago, Chile, in the summer of 1883, under the supervision of Mr. W.N. Stewart. This was the result of the success obtained with small isolated plants, leading to the formation of an Edison Company. It can readily be conceived that at such an extreme distance from the source of supply of apparatus, the plant was subject to many peculiar difficulties from the outset, of which Mr. Stewart speaks as follows. I made an exhibition of the Jumbo in the theater at Santiago, and on the first evening, when it was filled with the aristocracy of the city, I discovered to my horror that the binding wire around the armature was slowly stripping off and going to pieces. We had no means of boring out the field magnets, and we cut grooves in them. I think the machine is still running. The station went into operation soon after with an equipment of 8 Edison K dynamos with certain conditions inimical to efficiency, but which had not hindered the splendid expansion of the local system. With those 8 dynamos, we had 4 belts between each engine and the dynamo. The steam pressure was limited to 75 pounds per square inch. We had 2 wire underground feeders sent without any plans or specifications for their installation. The station had neither voltmeter nor ammeter. The current pressure was regulated by a galvanometer. We were using coal costing $12 a ton and were paid for our light in currency worth 50 cents on the dollar. The only thing I can be proud of in connection with the plant is the fact that I did not design it, that once in a while we made out to pay its operating expenses, and that occasionally we could run it for 3 months without a total breakdown. It was not until 1885 that the first Edison station in Germany was established, but the art was still very young, and the plant represented pioneer lighting practice in the empire. The station at Berlin comprised 5 boilers and 6 vertical steam engines driving by belts 12 Edison dynamos, each of about 55 horsepower capacity. A model of this station is preserved in the Deutschen Museum in Munich. The chapter would not be complete if it failed to include some reference to a few of the earlier isolated plants of a historic character. Note has already been made of the first Edison plants afloat on the Jeannette in Columbia and the first commercial plant in the New York lithographic establishment. The first mill plant was placed in the woolen factory of James Harrison at Newburgh, New York, about September 15, 1881. A year later, Mr. Harrison wrote with some pride, I believe my mill was the first lighted with your electric light and therefore may be called number one. Besides being job number one, it is number one job, and number one light being better and cheaper than gas and absolutely safe as to fire. The first steam yacht lighted by incandescent lamps was James Gordon Bennett's Nanuma, equipped early in 1882 with a plant for 120 lamps of 8 candle power, which remained in use there many years afterward. The first Edison plant in a hotel was started in October 1881 at the Blue Mountain House in the Adirondacks, and consisted of 2 Z dynamos with a complement of 8 and 16 candle lamps. The hotel is situated at an elevation of 3,500 feet above the sea and was at that time 40 miles from the railroad. The machinery was taken up in pieces on the backs of mules from the foot of the mountain. The boilers were fired by wood as the economical transportation of coal was a physical impossibility. For a 6-hour run of the plant, 1/4 of a cord of wood was required at a cost of 25 cents per cord. The first theater in the United States to be lighted by an Edison isolated plant was the Bijou Theater, Boston. The installation of boilers, engines, dynamos, wiring, switches, fixtures, 3 stage regulators, and 650 lamps was completed in 11 days after receipt of the order, and the plant was successfully operated at the opening of the theater on December 12, 1882. The first plant to be placed on a United States steamship was the one consisting of an Edison Z dynamo and 128 candle lamps installed on the Fish Commission steamer Albatross in 1883. The most interesting feature of this installation was the employment of special deep-sea lamps supplied with current through a cable 940 feet in length for the purpose of alluring fish. By means of the brilliancy of the lamps, marine animals in the lower depths were attracted and then easily ensnared.